But in Odong, Odong Forest. Arirang, Arirang, give me back my love. When I was finished, the dear leader seemed not to hear the faint song answering back. I was taken to his personal train car, where the windows were so thick that the light through them was green and warped. Here, he asked me to recite lines from a story he had typed out. It was called Tyrants Asunder. How could he fail to smell the urine on me, or the stink of hunger that creeps up your throat and infects your breath? I spoke the words, though they had no meaning for me in that state. I could barely finish a sentence without succumbing. Then the dear leader called out, "Bravo!" and showered me with applause. "Tell me," he said. "Tell me you will memorize my lines. Say you will accept the role." How could he know that I didn't really understand what a movie was? That I'd only heard broadcasts of revolutionary operas? How could I know that on the dear leader's train there were other cars whose construction was for propositions much less noble than auditions? Here the dear leader gestured large, as if we were now in a theater. "Of course, such is the subtlety of this art form," he added, "that my lines will become yours. The people will see you fill the screen, and remember only the emotion of your voice bringing the words to life." The train beneath me started moving. "Please," I called out. It was almost a scream. "My mother must be safe." "Certainly," he said. "I'll have someone check on her." I don't know what came over me. I raised my eyes to his. "Safe forever," I said. He smiled with a surprise of new appreciation. "Safe forever," he agreed. I saw that he responded to conditions. He spoke the language of rules. "Then I'll do it," I told him. "I'll perform your story." This is the moment I was discovered. How fondly the dear leader recalls it, as if through his keen insight and wisdom, I was saved from some destructive natural force, such as a landslide. It was a story he loved to recount over the years, when we were alone in his opera box, or sailing through the sky on his personal gondola. This story of fortune bringing our two trains together. He never meant it as a threat to me, to remind me of how far I had to fall. Rather, it was a reminder of the forever of us. Through the green of the window, I watched the train bearing my mother recede. "I knew you'd agree," the dear leader said. "I had a feeling. I'll cancel the other actress right away. In the meantime, let's get you some proper clothes. And that ear of yours could use some attention."
In the dark, Commander Ga said the word, "cancel."
"Cancel,"
Sun Moon repeated.
"How many times have I thought of that other girl? How could the dear leader know that my arms still go cold for her?"
"What happened to her?" Ga asked.
"You know what happened to her," she said.
They were quiet a moment.
"There is another thing the dear leader doesn't know about me," she said. "But it's something he'll soon find out."
"What's that?"
"I'm going to recreate one of my grandmother's songs. In America, I will discover the missing words, and this song, it will be about him. It will contain everything of this place that I could never utter, every last bit of it. And I'm going to sing it on the state channel of America's Central Broadcasting Division, and everyone in the world will know the truth of him."
"The rest of the world knows the truth of him," he said.
"No, they don't," she said. "They won't know it until they hear it in my voice. It's a song I thought I'd never get to sing."
Sun Moon struck a match. In the flash of it, she said,
"And then you came along. Do you see that the dear leader has no idea that I'm the purest actress? That it's not just when I speak his lines, but every single moment? It is also the actress that I have shown you. But that's not who I am. Though I must act all the time. Inside, I'm simply a woman.
He blew out the match and took her arm, rolling her to him. It was the arm he'd grabbed before. This time she didn't pull back. His face was near hers and he could feel her breath as it came. She reached out and gripped his shirt.
Show it to me, she said.
But it's dark. You won't be able to see it.
I want to feel it, she told him.
He pulled his shirt over his head and leaned to her, so that his tattoo was at her fingertips. She traced his muscles, felt the flare of his ribs.
Maybe I should get one, she said.
One what? A tattoo? He asked. What would you get a tattoo of?
Who do you suggest?
It depends. Where on your body would this tattoo be inked? She pulled the shift over her head and took his hand, placing it with both of hers over her heart.
What do you think of here?
He felt the delicacy of her skin, the suggestion of her breasts. Most of all, he felt against his palm, the heat of her blood and how her heart pumped it through her body, down her arms and into the hands that clasped the back of his, so that the sensation was of being engulfed by her. This is an easy one, he said. The tattoo to place over your heart is the image of what's inside your heart. Leaning close, he kissed her. It was long and singular, and his eyes closed with the parting of their lips. After, she was silent, and he became afraid, not knowing what she was thinking.
Sun Moon, are you there?
I'm here, she said. A song just ran through my head.
A good one or a bad one?
There's only one kind.
Is it true? Have you really never sung for pleasure?
What song would you have me sing? She asked him.
One about spilling blood, celebrating martyrdom, glorifying lies?
Is there no song at all? What about a love song?
Name one that hasn't been twisted into being about our love for the dear leader.
In the dark, he let his hand roam over her, the hollow above her collarbone, that taut cord in her neck, the fine point of her shoulder. There's one song I know, he told her.
How does it go?
I only know the opening. I heard it in America.
Tell me.
She's the yellow rose of Texas, he said.
She's the yellow rose of Texas, she sang.
The English words were thick in her mouth, but the sound, her voice, it was lovely. He delicately touched her lips so he could feel her sing the words. I'm going for to see.
I'm going for to see.
When I finally find her, I'll have her marry me.
What do the words mean?
They're about a woman whose beauty is like a rare flower. There is a man who has a great love for her. A love he's been saving up for his entire life. And it doesn't matter that he must make a great journey to her. And it doesn't matter if their time together is brief, that afterward he might lose her, for she is the flower of his heart, and nothing will keep him from her.
The man in the song, she said. Is he you?
You know I'm him.
I'm not the woman in the song, she said. I'm not an actress or a singer or a flower. I'm just a woman. Do you want to know this woman? Do you want to be the only man in the world who knows the real Sun Moon?
You know I do. Here she raised her body some to allow him to pull free her last garment.
Do you know what happens to men who fall in love with me? She asked.
Ga took a moment to think about it. They get locked in your tunnel and fed nothing but broth for 2 weeks? Playfully, she said,
No.
Ga said. Your neighbor tries to give them botulism and then they get punched in the nose by the deer leader's driver?
No.
Okay, I give up. What happens to men who fall for you? She shimmied her body so that her hips were under his.
They fall forever, she said.
After the loss of Zhizhak and Qiuqi's defection to the Pubyok, I stayed away from Division 42. I know I roamed the city, but for how long? A week? And where did I go? Did I wander the people's footpath, watching birds hopelessly hover above the snares that held their feet? Did I inhabit the Kumsuzan mausoleum, where I endlessly stared into the chrome and glass coffin of Kim Il-sung, his body glowing red under preservation lamps? Or did I study the urchin master as he used his truck, disguised as an ice cream van, to rid Pyongyang's alleys of beggar boys? Did I at any time recall recruiting Zhizhak at Kim Il-sung University's career day, where I wore a suit and a tie as I showed the boy our color brochures and explained to him that interrogation wasn't about violence anymore, that it was about the highest order of intellectual gamesmanship, where the tools were creative thinking and the stakes were national security? Perhaps I sat in Mansu Park, watching virgins soak their uniforms with sweat as they chopped firewood. Wouldn't I have here pondered the notion that I was alone, that my team was gone, that my interns were gone, that my successes were gone, that my chances at love and friendship and family seemed all but gone? Maybe my mind was empty as I stood in line for buses I didn't intend to take. And maybe I thought nothing as I was rounded up for a sandbag brigade. Or perhaps I was reclined the whole time on the blue vinyl of an autopilot chair, imagining such things? And what was wrong with my memory? How come I didn't recollect how I spent these painful days? And why was I okay with the fact that I couldn't recall them? I preferred it this way, didn't I? Compared to forgetting, did living really stand a chance? I was nervous when I finally returned to Division 42. Descending the final staircase, I wasn't sure what I would find. But all seemed active and normal. There were new cases on the big board, and red lights glowed above the holding tanks. Qiuqi walked past, new intern in tow. Good to see you, sir, she said. Sarge was particularly jovial. There's our interrogator, he said. Good to have you back. He said it in a way that suggested he was talking about more than my recent absence. He had a large metal object on the workbench. Hey, Sarge, I said.
Sarge?
He asked.
Who's that?
I mean, comrade, sorry, I said.
There's the spirit,
Sarge said. Just then, Commander Park walked by, limping, his arm in a sling. He had something in his hand. I couldn't make it out, but it was pink and wet and raw. Let me tell you, Commander Park, with his scarified face, was one sinister figure. The way he looked at you with those dead eyes in their marred sockets. It was like he belonged in some kind of spooky movie about evil dictators in Africa or something. He wrapped the item in newspaper, then sent it via vacuum tube deep into the bunker under us. He wiped his hand on his pants and left. Sarge snapped his fingers in my face.
Comrade,
he said. Sorry, I said. I haven't seen Commander Park up here before.
He's the commander,
Sarge said. He's the commander, I echoed.
Look, Sarge said. I know you got caught up in the harvest, and your apartment is on the 22nd floor. I know you don't get priority seating on the subway.
Here he reached in his pocket.
So I got you a little something, he said. Something to dispense with all of life's little problems.
I was sure it would be the next generation sedative I'd heard rumors of. Instead, he produced a shiny new Pubyok badge.
There's no such thing as a team of one, he said, offering it to me. You're a smart guy. We need a smart guy. Kyuki learned a lot from you. Come on, be smart. You can keep working with her.
Gah steal my case, I said. I need to see it through.
That's something I can respect, Sarge said. I wouldn't have it any other way. Finish your work, by all means, then join the team.
When I took the badge, he said,
I'll have the boys schedule your haircutting party.
I turned the badge in my hand. There was no name on it, just a number. Sarge took me by the shoulder.
Come, check this out, he said.
At the workbench, he handed me the metal object. It weighed a tremendous amount. I could barely wield it. It had a solid handle that connected to a strip of writing cast from forged metal.
What language is that? I asked.
English? Sarge nodded.
But even if you did know English, he said, you wouldn't be able to read it. The writing is backward.
He took it from me so that he could indicate the script.
It's called a brand. Pure iron. Custom smelted. You use it to make a mark of possession, which you can then read forward. I can't remember if it says Property of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or if it says Property of the Dear Leader Kim Jong-il.
Sarge studied my face to see if I would make a smart remark like, what's the difference? When I didn't, he smiled and nodded in approval. I looked for a power cord on the device, but saw nothing. How's it work?
Easy, he said. It's old American technology. You put it in a bed of coals until it's red hot. Then you burn the message in.
Into what? I asked.
Commander Ga, he said. They're going to brand him at dawn in the soccer stadium.
The ghouls, I thought, though I tried hard to show no emotion. Is that what Commander Park was doing here?
No, Sarge said. The Dear Leader sent Commander Park here on a personal errand. It seems the Dear Leader misses Sun-moon and wanted a last image to remember her by.
I stared at Sarge, trying to comprehend what he was saying, but as a sly smile crossed his face, I turned and ran as fast as I could to Commander Gaw. I found him in one of the soundproof holding tanks.
They're going to do it in the morning,
Gaw said when I entered his room. He was lying on an interrogation table, shirtless, his hands in restraints.
They're going to take me to the soccer stadium and brand me in front of everyone.
But I couldn't hear his words. I only stared at his chest. I neared slowly, my eyes fixated on the raw red square where his tattoo of Sun Moon used to be. There had been much blood. The table was dripping with it. But now, only a clear fluid wept from the wound, leaving pinkish ribbons trailing down his ribs.
I could use a bandage, he said.
I looked around the room, but there was nothing. I watched the chill run across his body. This was followed by a couple of deep breaths, which caused him great pain. A strange laugh came out of him, filled with agony.
They didn't even ask me about the actress, he said.
I guess that means you beat them. His jaw seized with the pain, so he could only nod. He snatched a couple of quick breaths, then said,
If you ever get a choice between Commander Park with a box cutter.
Here,
He clenched his teeth a moment.
In a shark.
I put my hand on his forehead, which was running with sweat.
Take the shark, right?
Look, I said. Don't talk. There's no need to be funny. Don't try to be Comrade Pyuk. The name I could tell caused him the greatest pain of all.
It wasn't supposed to work like that, Ga said.
Pyuk wasn't supposed to get hurt.
You just worry about yourself, I said.
Sweat was pooling in Ga's eyes, which were burning with worry.
Is this what happened to Pyuk? He asked.
I used my shirt tail to dry his eyes.
No, I said. Pyuk went on his own terms.
Ga nodded, his lower jaw shuddering. Sarge came in, grinning.
What do you think of the great Commander Ga now? He asked. He's the most dangerous man in our nation, you know.
That's not the real Commander Ga, I reminded Sarge. This is just a man.
Sarge came astride Commander Ga's table. Wincing, Commander Ga tried to roll his head as far from Sarge as possible. Yet Sarge neared, leaning over Commander Ga as if to inspect the wound up close. Sarge looked back at me, smiling.
Oh yes, he said. The good commander here has had pain training.
Then Sarge took a breath and blew into Ga's wound.
The scream that followed made my ears sing.
He's ready to talk now, Sarge said. And you're going to get his confession.
I looked to Commander Ga, who took shallow, trembling breaths.
But what about his biography? I asked Sarge.
You understand this is the last biography, right?
He told me.
That age is over. But you can do anything you like, as long as we have his confession in hand when they take him to the stadium at first light.
When I nodded, Sarge left. I leaned close to Commander Ga. His skin would frost with goose pimples, then go slack. He wasn't a hero. He was just a man, pushed farther than any man should be pushed. Looking at him now, I understood the fairy tale he had told us about the little orphan boy who had licked honey from the deer leader's claws. The night Ga told us that story, I realized was the last time my team was whole and together.
I'm not going to let the bear get you, I told him. I'm not going to let them do what they're planning to do.
There were tears in Ga's eyes.
Bandage,
is all he could say. I have an errand to run, I told him. Then I'll be back to save you. At the glory of Mount Paektu housing block, I didn't bound up the 21 flights to my parents. I took the stairs slowly for once, feeling the labor of each step. I couldn't get that brand out of my mind. I saw it scalding red and bubbly across Commander Ga. I imagined its scars ancient and discolored, running down the thick backs of all the old pubyok. I saw Kyuki's perfect body disfigured by it. A burn from neck to navel, splitting the breasts toward the sternum, the belly, and below. I didn't use my pubyok badge to board the subway's priority seating car. I sat with the average citizens, and on all their bodies, I couldn't help but see property of in raised pink letters. The mark was on everyone. Only now could I finally see it. It was the ultimate perversion of the communist dream I had been taught since childhood. I felt like retching the turnips in my stomach. I was almost never home in the middle of the day. I took the opportunity to remove my shoes in the hall and ever so silently slipped my key in the lock. Opening the door, I lifted up on the knob so the door's hinges wouldn't squeak. Inside, the loudspeaker was blaring, and my parents were at the table with some of my files open and spread before them. They were whispering to one another as they ran their fingers across the pages, feeling the file labels and paper clips, the embossed stamps and raised department seals. I knew better than to leave important files at home anymore. These were just requisition forms. I pushed the door shut behind me. It squealed in its arc until the lock clicked tight. The two of them froze.
"Who is it?"
my father asked.
"Who's there?"
"Are you a thief?" my mother asked. "I assure you, we have nothing to steal."
They were both looking right at me, though they seemed not to see me. Across the table, their hands sought one another and joined.
"Go away," my father said. "Leave us alone, or we'll tell our son."
My mother felt around the table until she located a spoon. She grabbed the handle and held it out like a knife.
"You don't want my son to find out about this," she said. "He's a torturer."
"Mother, father," I said. "No need to worry. It is I, your son."
"But it's the middle of the day," my father said. "Is everything okay?"
"Everything's fine," I told him. I walked to the table and closed the files.
"You're barefoot," my mother said.
"I am." I could see the marks on them. I could see that they had been branded.
"But I don't understand," my father said.
"I'm going to have a long night," I told him, "and some long tomorrows to follow. I won't be here to cook your dinner or help you down the hall to the bathroom."
"Don't worry about us," my mother said. "We can manage. If you have to go, go."
"I do have to go," I said. I walked to the kitchen. From a drawer, I removed the can opener. I paused there at the window. Spending my days underground, I wasn't used to the midday brightness. I observed the spoon and pan and hot plate my mother cooked with. I stared at the drying rack where two glass bowls caught the light. I decided against bowls. "I think you're afraid of me," I said to them, "because I'm a mystery to you, because you don't really know me." I thought they'd protest, but they were silent. I reached to the top shelf and found a can of peaches. I blew on the lid, but it hadn't been there long enough to gather much dust. At the table, I took the spoon from my mother's hand and sat, the items before me.
"Well, you won't have to worry ever again," I told them, "because today you're going to meet the real me."
I sank the opener into the can and began to cut a slow circle. My father sniffed the air.
"Peaches?"
he asked.
"That's right," I said.
"Peaches in their own sweet liquor."
"From the night market?"
mother asked.
"Actually, I stole them from the evidence locker."
My father inhaled deeply.
"I can just see them, plain as day. The thick juice they're in. The way they glow in the light."
"It's been so long since I've tasted a peach," my mother said.
"We used to get a coupon for a can every month in our ration book."
My father said,
"Oh, that was years ago."
"I suppose you're right," my mother answered. "I'm just saying that we used to love peaches, and then one day you couldn't get them anymore."
"Well, allow me then," I told them. "Open."
Like children, they opened their mouths. In anticipation, my father closed his milky eyes. I stirred the peaches in their can, then selected a slice. Passing the bottom of the spoon across the edge of the can, I caught the dripping syrup. Then I reached and slipped the slice into my mother's mouth.
"Mmm,"
she said. I fed my father next.
"That, son,"
he said,
"was a peach."
There was silence,
except for the blaring loudspeaker as they savored the moment. In unison, they said,
"Thank you, dear leader Kim Jong-il."
"Yes," I said, "you have him to thank." I stirred the can again, hunted down the next slice. "I have a new friend," I said.
"A friend from work?"
my father asked. "Yes, a friend from work," I said. "The two of us have become quite intimate. He's given me hope that love is out there for me. He's a man who has true love. I've studied his case very closely, and I think the secret to love is sacrifice. He himself has made the ultimate sacrifice for the woman he loves."
"He gave his life for her?"
my father asked. "Actually, he took her life," I told him, and popped a peach in his mouth. There was a quake in my mother's voice.
"We're happy for you," she said. "As the dear leader says, love makes the world go round. So don't hesitate. Go find that true love. Don't worry about us. We'll be fine. We can take care of ourselves."
I spooned a slice into her mouth. It caught her by surprise, and she coughed.
"Perhaps from time to time," I said. "You have seen me writing in my journal. It's actually not a journal. It's a personal biography. As you know, that's what I do for a living, write people's biographies, which we keep in what you might call a private library. A guy I work with, I call him Sarge, says the problem with my biographies is that no one ever reads them." This brings me to my new friend, who told me that the only people in the world who would want to read his biography were gone. I dished out new slices with ample syrup.
"People," my father said, "meaning the lady that your friend loves."
"Yes," I said.
"The lady that your friend killed," mother said.
"And her kids," I said. "There's a tragic aspect to the story. There's no denying it." I nodded my head at the truth of that. It would have made a good subtitle for his biography. Commander Ga, a tragedy. Or whatever his name was. The peaches were half gone. I stirred them in their can, selecting a new slice.
"Save some for yourself," my father said.
"Yes, that's enough," my mother said. "I haven't tasted sweet in so long. My stomach cannot handle it."
I shook my head no. "This is a rare can of peaches," I said. I was going to keep them for myself, but taking the easy way, that's not the answer to life's problems. My mother's lip started to quiver. She covered it with her hand. "But back to my problem," I said. "My biography and the difficulty I've had writing it. This biographer's block I've been suffering from. I see it so clearly now. Came from the fact that deep down, I knew no one wanted to hear my story. Then my friend, he had the insight that his tattoo wasn't public, but personal. Though it was there for the world to see, it was truly for no one but himself. Losing that, he lost everything, really."
"How can a person lose a tattoo?"
my father asked. "Unfortunately, it's easier than you'd think," I told him. It got me thinking, though, and I realized I wasn't composing for posterity or the dear leader, or for the good of the citizenry. No, the people who needed to hear my story were the people I loved. The people right in front of me, who had started to think of me as a stranger, who were scared of me because they no longer knew the real me.
"But your friend, he killed the people he loved, right?"
"It's unfortunate, I know," I said. "There's no forgiving him for it. He hasn't even asked. But let me get started with my biography. I was born in Pyongyang," I began, "to parents who were factory workers. My mother and father were older, but they were good parents. They survived every worker purge and avoided denunciation and re-education."
"But we already know these things,"
my father said.
"Shh," I told him. You can't talk back to a book. You don't get to rewrite a biography as you're reading it. Now, back to my story. As they finish the peaches, I relate to them how normal my childhood was, how I played the accordion and recorder at school, and while in the choir, I sang high alto in performances of "Our Codas Lift Us Higher." I memorized all the speeches of Kim Il-sung and got the highest marks in Juche theory. Then I began with the things they didn't know. One day a man from the party came to our school, I said. He loyalty tested all the boys, one at a time, in the maintenance shed. The test itself only lasted a couple of minutes, but it was quite difficult. I suppose that's the point of a test. I'm happy to say I passed the test. All of us did. But none of us ever spoke of it. It felt very liberating to finally speak of this, a topic I could never commit to paper. I knew suddenly that I would share everything with them, that we would be closer than ever. I would tell them of the humiliations I suffered in mandatory military service, of my one sexual encounter with a woman, of the cruel hazing I had received as an intern of the Pubyok. I don't mean to dwell on the subject of this loyalty test, but it changed how I saw things. Behind a chest of medals might be a hero or a man with an eager index finger. I became a suspicious boy who knew there was always something more beneath the surface, if you're willing to probe. It perhaps set me down my career path, a trajectory that has confirmed that there is no such thing as the right-minded, self-sacrificing citizen the government tells us we all are. I'm not complaining, mind you, merely explaining. I didn't have it half as rough as some. I didn't grow up in an orphanage like my friend Commander Gaw.
Commander Gaw?
My father asked.
Is that your new friend?
I nodded.
Answer me, my father said. Is Commander Gaw your new friend?
Yes, I said.
But you can't trust the Commander Gaw, my mother said. He's a coward and a criminal.
Yes, my father added.
He's an imposter.
You don't know Commander Gaw, I told him. Have you been reading my files?
We don't need to read any files, my father said. We have it on the highest authority. Commander Gaw's an enemy of the state.
Not to mention his weaselly friend, Comrade Pyuk, my mother added.
Don't even say that name,
my father cautioned.
How do you know all this? I asked.
Tell me about this authority.
They both pointed toward the loudspeaker. Every day they tell some of his story, my mother said, of him and Sun Moon.
Yes, my father said.
Yesterday was episode 5. In it, Commander Gaw drives to the opera house with Sun Moon. But it's not really Commander Gaw, you see. Stop it, I said.
That's impossible. I've made very little progress on his biography. It doesn't even have an ending.
Listen for yourself, my mother said. The loudspeaker doesn't lie. The next installment is this afternoon.
I dragged a chair to the kitchen where I used it to reach the loudspeaker. Even after I tore it from the wall, it was connected to a cable that kept it squawking. Only with a meat knife was I able to shut it up.
What's happening? My mother asked. What are you doing?
My father was hysterical.
What if the Americans sneak attack? He asked. How will we receive the warning?
You won't have to worry about sneak attacks anymore, I told them. My father moved to protest, but a stream of saliva ran from his mouth. He reached for his mouth and felt his lips, as if they had gone numb. And one of my mother's hands was showing a tremor. She stilled it with her other hand. the botulism toxin was beginning to bloom inside them. The time for suspicions and arguments was over. I remember that horrible picture of Comrade Pyeok's family, crumpled beneath the table. I was resolved that my parents wouldn't suffer such indignities. I gave them each a tall glass of water and placed them on their cots to await the fall of night. All afternoon and into the twilight, I gave them the gift of my story, every bit of it, and I left nothing out. I stared out the window as I spoke, and I concluded only when they had begun to writhe on their cots. I couldn't act until darkness arrived, and when it finally did, the city of Pyongyang was like that black cricket in the fairy tale. It was everywhere and nowhere, its chirp annoying only those who ignored the final call to slumber. The moon shimmered off the river, and after the eagle owls had struck, you could hear nothing of the sheep and goats but the clicking of their teeth as they chewed grass in the dark. When darkness was total and my parents had lost their faculties, I kissed them goodbye, for I could not bear to witness the inevitable. A sure sign of botulism is a loss of vision, so I only hoped they had never known what had struck them. I looked around the room a last time. At our family photograph, my father's harmonica, their wedding rings. But I left it all. I could take nothing where I was going. There was no way Commander Ga could attempt the arduous journey ahead with an open wound. At the night market, I bartered my pubic patch for some iodine and a large compress. Crossing the city in the dark, headed for Division 42, I felt the stillness of the big machine at rest. There was no thrum of electricity in the wires overhead or gurgle of the water in the pipes. Pyongyang was coiling in the dark to pounce upon the next day. And how I loved the capital springing to life, morning wood smoke in the air, the smell of frying radishes, the hot burn of trolley brakes. I was a city boy. I would miss the metropolis, its hubbub and vitality. If only there were a place here for a person who gathered human stories and wrote them down. But Pyongyang is already filled with obituary writers. And I can't stand propaganda. You would think a person would get used to cruel fates. When I appeared in Commander Ga's room, he asked, "Is it morning already?" "Not yet," I told him. "There's still time." I tried to minister to Commander Ga as best I could. The iodine turned my fingers red, making it look as if I were the one who had brutalized the man before me. But when I placed the bandage on Commander Ga, the wound disappeared. I used a whole roll of tape to secure it. "I'm getting out of here," I told him. "Would you like me to bring you along?" He nodded. "Do you care where you're going? Or about the obstacles ahead?" He shook his head. "No," he said. "Are you ready? Do you need to do anything to prepare?" "No," he told me. "I am ready." I helped him up. Then Sailor carried him across Division 42 to an interrogation bay where I rolled him into a baby blue chair. "This is where you gave me an aspirin when I first came," he said. "It seems like so long ago." "It won't be a bad journey," I told him. "On the other side, there won't be pubic or cattle prods or branding irons. Hopefully, you'll get sent to a rural farm collective. Not an easy life, but you can start a new family and serve your nation in the true spirit of communism through labor and devotion." "I had my life," Commander Ga said. "I'll pass on the rest." I grabbed two sedatives. When Commander Ga declined one, I took them both. From the supply cabinet I flipped through the diapers until I found a medium. "Would you like one?" I asked. "We keep some on hand for when VIPs come through. It can save some embarrassment. I have a large right here."
"No, thanks," he said.
I dropped my trousers and secured mine using the adhesive tabs.
"You know, I respect you," I said.
"You were the only guy who came through that never talked. You were smart. If you had told us where the actress was, they would have killed you right away."
"Are you going to hook me up to this machine?"
I nodded. He looked at the autopilot's wires and energy meters.
"There's no mystery," he said. "The actress simply defected."
"You never stop, do you? You're about to lose everything you own but your heartbeat. And still you're trying to throw us off the trail."
"It's true," he said. "She got on an airplane and flew away."
"Impossible," I told him.
"Sure, a few peasants risk life and limb to cross an icy river. But our national actress? Under the nose of the dear leader? You insult me."
I handed him a pair of paper booties. He sat on his baby blue chair, and I sat on mine, and together we removed our shoes and socks to put them on.
"Not to insult you," he said, "but whose pictures do you think are on my phone? My wife and children vanish, but then, from far away, photos of a woman and her children appear. Is that such a mystery?"
"It's a conundrum, I'll admit. I pondered it much, but I know that you kill the people you loved. There's no other way." I pulled his phone from my pocket and used its buttons to erase the pictures. "If an interrogator starts questioning the only thing he knows for sure, then... But please, I'm not that person anymore. I no longer take biographies. Only my own story concerns me now." I dropped the phone into a stainless steel basin, along with a few coins and my ID badge, which said only interrogator. He indicated the leather restraints.
"You are not going to put these on me, are you?"
"I have to, I'm sorry. I'll need people to know that I did this to you, and not the other way around." I reclined his chair, then strapped down his legs and arms. I did him the favor of leaving the buckles pretty loose. "I'm sorry I didn't manage to finish your biography," I told him. "If I hadn't failed, I could have sent your biography with you so when you reach the other side, you could read who you were and become you again."
"Don't worry," he told me. "She'll be on the other side. She'll recognize me and tell me who I am."
"I can offer you this," I said, holding up a pen. "If you like, you can write your name someplace on your body, a place they won't notice, on your umgyeong or between your toes. That way later, you might discover who you were. I'm not trying to trick you to learn your identity, I assure you."
"Are you going to do it?"
"I don't want to know who I was," I said.
"I don't even know what name I'd write," he told me.
I knelt to connect all the electrodes to his cranium. "You know they're telling your story over the loudspeakers," I said.
"Why?"
he asked. "I don't know, but since you're not going to be repenting in the soccer stadium tomorrow, I figure they'll have to come up with a new ending for your story."
"An ending to my story," he said. "My story's ended 10 times already. And yet, it never stops. The end keeps coming for me. And yet it takes everyone else. Orphans, friends, commanding officers. I outlast them all.
He was clearly confusing himself and his story, which is the natural result of certain tribulations. "This isn't the end of you," I told him. "It's a new beginning, and you haven't outlasted all your friends." "We're friends, aren't we?" He stared at the ceiling as though a parade of people he had once known were passing there. "I know why I'm in this blue chair," he said. "What about you?" Aligning all the red and white wires leading from his skull was like braiding hair. "This used to be a place," I told him, "where meaningful work was done. Here, a citizen was separated from his story. That was my job. Of the two, it was the story that was kept, while the person was disposed of. I was okay with that. In this way, many deviants and counter-revolutionaries were discovered. True, sometimes the innocent fell with the guilty, but there is no other way to discover the truth, and unfortunately, once a person has his story taken, by the roots, if you will, it can't be given back. But now..." Ga craned his neck to look at me.
"Yes?"
"Now the person is lost along with his life. Both die." I adjusted the output dial of his autopilot. Ga had a strong mind, so I set it at 8. "Tell me again how intimacy works," I asked.
"It turned out to be easy," Ga said. "You tell someone everything, the good, the bad, what makes you look strong and what's shameful as well. If you killed your wife's husband, you must tell her. If someone tried to man attack you, you must tell that too. I told you everything as best as I was able. I may not know who I am, but the actress is free. I'm not sure I understand freedom, but I felt it, and she now has it too." I nodded. It was satisfying to hear again. It restored my inner calm. With my parents, I'd finally been intimate. And Commander Ga was my friend, despite the lie about the actress being alive. He had so fully digested it that it had somehow become true to him. By his twisted logic, he was telling me, his friend, the absolute truth. "See you on the other side," I said. He fixed his eyes at some point that didn't exist. "My mother was a singer," he said. When he closed his eyes, I flipped the switch. He made the usual involuntary motions, eye flashing, arm levitation, gulping for air like a carp at the surface of a meditation pond. "My mother was a singer," were his last words, as if they were the only ones he could trust to describe who he had been. I climbed into the next blue chair but didn't bother with the restraints. I wanted the Pubyok to know that I had chosen my own path, that had rejected their ways. I hooked up my own wiring harness and turned my attention to the autopilot's output dial. I never wanted to remember a thing about this place, so I set it at 8.5. But then again, I didn't want a lobotomy either. I adjusted it to 7.5. And if I was being intimate with myself, I could also admit I was afraid of the pain. I settled for 6.5. Trembling with hope, and strangely, regret, my finger flipped the switch. My arms rose before me. They looked like someone else's arms. I heard moaning and realized it was me. A tongue of electricity licked deep inside my brain, probing as molars are inspected after a meal. I had imagined the experience would be one of numbness, but my thinking was hyper, thoughts flying. Everything was singular. The gleam of a metal armature, the violent green of a fly's eye. There was only the thing itself, without connection or context, as if everything in your mind had become unlinked to everything else. Blue and leather and chair. I couldn't put them together. The scent of ozone was without precedent. The incandescence of a light bulb lacked all antecedent. The fine hairs in my nose stiffened. My erection stood abominable and alone. I saw no icy peak or white flower. I scanned the room for them, but saw only elements. Shine, slick, coarse, shade. I became aware of Commander Ga moving beside me, arms aloft. It was all I could do to roll my head slightly to observe him. He had an arm free from its restraint, and he was reaching for the dial. I saw him turn it to maximum, a lethal dose. But I could worry about him no longer. I was on my own voyage. Soon I would be in a rural village, green and peaceful, where people swung their scythes in silence. There would be a widow there, and we would waste no time on courtship. I would approach her and tell her I was her new husband. We would enter the bed from opposite sides at first. For a while, she would have rules, but eventually, our genitals would intercourse in a way that was correct and satisfying. At night, after I had made my emission, we would lie there, listening to the sounds of our children running in the dark, catching summer frogs. My wife would have the use of both her eyes, so she would know when I blew out the candle. In this village, I would have a name, and people would call me by it. When the candle went out, she would speak to me, telling me to sleep very, very deeply. And as the electricity stropped itself sharper in my mind, I listened for her voice, calling a name that would soon be mine.
In the morning, Commander Ga woke to the roaring engines of an American military cargo jet. The children were already awake, staring at the ceiling. They knew this wasn't the once-a-week flight to Beijing or the twice-monthly grasshopper to Vladivostok. The children had never even heard an airplane over Pyongyang, which was restricted airspace. Not once since the American firebombing raids of 1951 had a plane been spotted over the nation's capital. He roused Sun Moon, and together they listened to it head north, as if it had originated in Seoul, a direction from which nothing was allowed to come. He checked his watch. The Americans were 3 hours early. The dear leader would be furious. "They're flying low to announce their arrival," he said. "Very American." Sun Moon turned to him.
"So it's time."
He looked into her eyes to see what remained of their lovemaking last night, but she was looking forward and not back. "It's time," he said.
"Children," Sun Moon called, "we're going on an adventure today. Go put together some food for us."
When they were gone, she pulled on her robe and lit a cigarette at the window, watching the American Goliath lower its landing gear over the Taedong and descend toward the airport. She turned to Ga.
"There's something you need to understand," she said. "Where the dear leader is concerned, there's only one of me. He has many girls, an entire Gipumjo of them, but only I matter. He thinks that I reveal all to him, that emotions cross my face without my control, making me incapable of conspiring against him. I'm the only person in the world he thinks he can trust.
Then today, he will feel the sting."
"I'm not talking about him," she said. "This is about you. Understand,
that if I slip from the dear leader's grasp, someone is going to pay, and that price will be unimaginable. You can't stay.